and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, we go deep inside the mind of the criminally insane as actor Tom Hardy plays Bronson, Britain's most notorious lifer. I also do time with world cinema's hottest screenwriter as Guillermo Arriaga, Mexican master of the fractured narrative, directs Charlize Theron in The Burning Plain. And my regular sparring partner Zan Brooks joins me to review the week's releases, including Not Quite Hollywood and In the City of Sylvia. Much more fun than a life sentence, it's Film Weekly. This week sees the release of Bronson, a portrait of the man described as Britain's most violent criminal. Since 1974, Charlie Bronson, or Michael Peterson as he was born, has spent a total of 34 years in prison, with only two short periods on the outside. His crimes have ranged from robbery to kidnap and GBH. The film has already attracted controversy for glamorising violence and Britain's hardest criminal. But it's a hell of a part for an actor, so I spoke to Tom Hardy, who plays Charlie Bronson, and asked him whether he saw his role as the part of a lifetime.
That's funny, that's what the producer was saying as well. They're trying to get me to do it. Instinctively, as a, you know, I know as a performer when something's good and something's going to bring the accolades and respect that we all desire and we want for our careers, etc. But you know, you can also fall off and really, you know, mess that up, can't you? And turn in something which is utter pish.
But I mean, were you worried about that? Because you have to trust, you know, it's such a, I suppose, controversial subject in a way. You always know that that's going to attract some kind of media attention if you're playing this guy Bronson. But you also have to trust, because Nicholas Winding Refn, the director, he's got a kind of strange approach to it. So when you saw the script, you thought, A, it's controversial, B, it's kind of a weird way into it. There must have been some risk involved in the whole undertaking.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I think Nicholas came on to it a bit later, actually. I was involved a couple of years before it. My concern was to get Charlie as close as damn it and then put him in any sort of improvisational situation so you could change the writing on me. It wouldn't make a difference. Right. Nick wanted to do a film which wasn't really about Charlie Bronson, actually. Nick wanted to do a film about, you know, why a guy wants to be in prison. You know what I mean? But that's not, you know, it wasn't really... I think that was a little bit too judgmental, actually. That's for the audience to decide whether or not, you know, Charlie all his life has wanted to be in prison. You know what I mean? I just had a good look at him as much as I could in the time allocated and tried to show and tell as many observations and reflect them as I could do.
You had a look at him face to face, didn't you?
Yeah, and talk to him and, you know, just hung out with him as much as I could. And, you know, went through the script with him and looked at stuff and what he didn't like, what he did like, and look at patterns of his behaviour that I could. And, you know, do my best to gather as much information as I could and show and tell it.
My name's Charles Bronson. And all my life I've wanted to be famous. I knew I was made for better things. I just didn't know what else. This is the post office I did over. This is what I got away with. And this is what they gave me.
7 years!
Don't worry, son. You'll be out in four.
In a way, what fascinates me is that this film is much about the play of acting as well. In a way, you present Charlie Bronson as a kind of showman, in a way.
He kind of is.
So he, in a sense, is as an actor, there's much in the film that's about the acting process, or masks, if you like, which is what you were involved in.
Well, that's what the whole point is, masks and development of persona and postmodernism and the creating of a character. You can be anything that you want to be, and the distancing effect of masks and... You know, and then finally getting lost behind a mask, and actually nobody knows what makes this guy tick. Why? And I remember asking him, I was saying, Charlie, you know what I mean? You why do you do this? Because I mean, at the end of the day, you're just a very, so you're not. It's not like you're evil, and you're just a really, really. You act the behavior like a really naughty, naughty schoolboy. And in a way, that, you know, it is a storyteller. And that's why the vaudevillian strongman, or the circus strongman, or, you know, across with the green cross code man, Father Christmas, and the guy that's telling you, you know, how to look after yourself. And he's kind of he is that figure, that storytelling by the fire. I think he would have made an amazing Viking.
You know what I mean? That's probably what attracted Nicholas Winding Refn to it, because he's making the Viking movie.
Yeah, totally. I mean, he's the kind of guy you do want on your side if you're going, you know, into battle, but it's misguided.
Can I ask you about the actual process of actually becoming Charlie Bronson? I know you put on a lot of weight, which I know for some reason that always critics and journalists always get excited
a bit. Yeah. Love that shit.
What did you have to do?
That's eat. I mean, it's the new black. Yeah, just kept eating really and pushing the floor. Not very exciting. And carrying my mate Peanut, my personal trainer, up and down the stairs really in a fireman's lift for 5 weeks and put on 2.5 stone.
Wow. 2 stone. But you've still and you've kept it. I can see.
I lost it and I'm going back up now, but I had to lose the fat. So I'm going back up for a cage fighting film now. But I was 12.5 stone for Bronson. I've got to go up for 15.
You've got to go up to 15? Blimey, you're like Mickey Rourke and Robert De Niro all rolled into one.
No. Any method necessary now, I'm afraid. Yeah. Not quite as good as those boys at all.
What was it that clicked when you got the character? Because you got the voice, you got the look. What was it? Was there a certain weigh in as an actor? There's some people go for the walk, the hair, the moustache. What was it for you that clicked when you suddenly got the right... what you felt was the right Charlie?
Just utter belligerence for anybody who told me what it was. I'll tell you what it's like. Do you know what I mean? I'll tell you what it's like and smile. Do you know what I mean? There's a real, this is how it is, this is how it works, it doesn't work any other way.
So it was an attitude that struck you?
Also size to back it up, and a big moustache. Do you know what I mean? And a bald head. So there's,
you could have been Freddie Mercury.
Not really, no, you'd know the difference. You'd know the difference.
Tom Hardy there as Charlie Bronson, or Michael Peterson. Zan Brooks is in the pod with me today. Zan, what did you make of Bronson?
I loved it. I thought that Hardy was fantastic. I also thought it was a superb piece of work by the Danish director Nicholas Winding Refn, tackling a very British subject, and I think bringing something a bit different to it.
Yeah, had you seen his Pusher trilogy there?
Yeah.
The stuff he did, the underground stuff he did in Denmark, which I thought was very impressive stuff.
Yeah, he's a really talented filmmaker, and he's got a great kind of visual sense. And, you know, what he does with this film, it's a kind of theatrical kind of reinvention of Bronson's life, which is sort of fitting because there's something weirdly theatrical in a very scary way about Bronson himself. He's like, he looks like a kind of Victorian circus strongman, doesn't he, with his sort of twiddly moustache and his strange kind of intonation.
Or a member of the Village People.
But you wouldn't say that to him if you met him.
There is something about the film that I thought was terrific for about an hour, and then I thought it sort of lost a bit of momentum. I thought, well, where's it going to go? Because it can't really go anywhere because he's
anywhere.
Still in prison.
It just goes round and round the cage, doesn't it?
Which is, I think, that sort of problem. I would have kind of liked, as I said to Tom there, I would have kind of liked some comment from the author, from the director, some kind of, what do we think of Bronson? But I suppose it's left up to us to think about the systems. And in a way, it reminded me slightly of Hunger. You know, is it against the system or is it for the system? Is it showing the system up or is he a victim of the system?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've read that this film has been sort of accused of glamorising him, and yet maybe it does in the way that it's very beautiful to look at. It's a sort of a woozy retelling of his life. It's very seductive. Mm. And yet I'm not quite sure that that's stands up, because he comes across as a nasty piece of work.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to say, "Oh, I want to be like him." There are a lot of people out there who will go, "I want to be like him." He's
yeah,
a
possibly,
hero.
But that's their own problem.
And it's the not film, the film's fault.
It's not the film's fault. And you know, I don't think this film is making a case for why is this man in jail. I think it's quite apparent why he's in jail. He's a sociopath.
Yeah, and there's a brilliant scene in I think it's Broadmoor where they have all the kind of nutters incarcerated in this huge hall, and then they play the Pet Shop Boys. It's a sin.
It's a sin. Yeah, and they're all kind of dancing.
It's a terrific scene.
It's a terrific scene. Maybe again, that's dodgy. Maybe that's a kind of, you know, it's sort of tourism through the inferno of sort of mental health care, where you can kind of sit back and eat your popcorn and look at all these kind of casualties.
It's a little bit One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in terms of a scene, but it takes it into a much more British, kind of gritty and kind of grotty.
Gritty, grotty, but also sort of surrealistic as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it works. I like this a lot.
But so that's Bronson, Zan. Let's go down under for a film this week about the Australian B movie. Australia apparently was replete and awash with filthy, bawdy, busty, saucy comedies made by B-movies and gory horrors. They had certain fans, including the master of B-movie trash himself, Quentin Tarantino.
There was just a certain flavour about the Aussie exploitation. I call it Aussie exploitation.
Weird, wonderful, really strange movies.
Down and dirty.
Very fast and cheap.
Urban vulgarity.
bad language.
Cop that, you rotten pommy bastard.
Something's gonna blow up.
Sexual overtones.
Aussie bullies terrorizing people.
Murder, rape, and mayhem.
Thriller, chiller.
Slash and cut and kill.
Bad advertisements for Australia.
A documentary is out this week chronicling the rise of the B-movie in Australia. It's called Not Quite Hollywood, Zan. You and I have seen it. Did you enjoy your little trash-o-mondo down under?
I did, and it made me realise just how little I knew about this sort of subgenre, really. Yeah. I mean, there's a couple that kind of percolated through, like obviously sort of Mad Max. And I remember watching Razorback back when I was a kid.
I knew Razorback. That's the one about the killer warthog.
The killer pig. But the rest of them never really reached our shores. And there's always this kind of weird historical reinvention that when you talk about 70s Australian cinema, it's always like the Australian New Wave. It's films like Breaker Morant and My Brilliant Career and Picnic at Hanging Rock. And this was their sort of quest for great legitimacy, which everybody now applauds them for and says how marvellous. But, of course, in terms of sort of popular appeal, I'm guessing this kind of Ausploitation films were far more successful.
They seem to have garnered as many fans as they did detractors as well. There's lots of kind of film critics in this going, oh God, I hated that man. He was disgusting. I never want to see him again.
And they also kind of attracted sort of Hollywood stars who are slightly down on their luck, like Dennis Hopper, who, you know, in his real dog days in the 1970s, went over to make some of these films.
Interesting you say dog days, because he played sort of Mad Dog, Mad Dog Moran. And he was absolutely insane. Interesting to see Jeremy Thomas, sort of a revered producer here, who managed on The Last Emperor and The Naked Lunch. He was obviously in charge of this kind of Ausploitation movie, where Dennis Hopper had to be arrested and exported from the country.
Yeah, and also was declared dead from alcohol poisoning.
This is what we want from Dennis Hopper.
This is exactly. It's Dennis living up to the legend, isn't it? Really?
There was other good people who kind of tried their luck there, and they kind of find a lot of the old, I suppose the kind of Wendy Richards, the Barbara Windsors of Australia, yeah. Kind of talking about how they never minded taking their clothes off. In fact, it seemed to be kind of de rigueur.
Well, there's this weird timeline as well. It's almost like this sort of primitive life form gradually evolving in Australian cinema that was almost like moribund before the 1970s. And then suddenly, first off, you get the sex movie, and that's very successful. And then they kind of refine their palette, don't they? And they get more sophisticated and start doing the kind of the horror movie and the action movie.
The chopping heads off.
Yeah, and it is like sort of watching a kind of a frog come out of the ocean and sprout legs and start, you know,
and
evolving
into Paul Hogan.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, now we are where we are now.
It's probably a croc that comes out of
a croc, yeah. Or a platypus.
There are some good... let's stereotype them, why not? They do a pretty good job in this film of stereotyping this. Tarantino is a massive, massive fan of these things, and actually seems to have seen them all at some kind of midnight Australian film festival.
Yeah, and
down
says that he wasn't even aware that they were Australian, just thought the people spoke a bit funny. you know, but it is the sort of the flip side of Grindhouse, so you can totally understand why he's going for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it kind of transported me. Do I want to? What I thought it was actually quite a good way of getting to watch these films. I don't know if I ever want to sit through any of these films. As a documentary, I quite enjoyed it. It kicks off and opens the Australian Film Festival at the Barbican, which starts Thursday, the 12th of March. Barry Humphries, I noticed, Dame Edna, is kind of key in this movement.
It's very weird. He's like the sort of Zelig of Australia, isn't he? He's kind of identified with every single sort of cultural or anti-cultural kind of upsurge.
Is it him that's got the fantastic line in this, saying that Picnic at Hanging Rock would have been a much better movie if they'd all vomited? Zan, let's raise the tones. Like, there are two art house releases this week that we must touch on. You've seen one, I've seen the other. We'll start with yours, a Turkish film called Alone.
Yeah, a Turkish film called Alone, which I guess is only really art house because it's a Turkish film. This was a huge success in Turkey. And when we think of kind of Turkish cinema, we think of kind of Nuri Bilge Ceylan. Yeah. But this is very, very different. This is a kind of big sweeping romance set in kind of modern day Istanbul, where it's all kind of loft apartments and trilling iPhones.
I said it's the sort of the flip side of Nuri Bilge Ceylan.
Exactly. It's going from a completely
districts.
Different thing. And, you know, it's that odd thing that foreign, what we get from foreign language films actually says only the tip of the iceberg about foreign language films. And this is one of those films I suspect probably won't really translate. It's a kind of weird mix of trying to be a kind of Hollywood copycat romantic drama, but then with kind of just weird little local details in there,
so
too.
So it's just commercially minded for...
It's a very commercially
Turkish
minded
people
film.
Turkish people want to go to sort of the Richard Curtis-y Turkish
kind it is, of yeah, it is. And yet, you know, this is a Richard Curtis-y kind of Turkish film where the hero runs a big successful restaurant and likes kind of consorting with his prostitutes, but then falls in love. And, you know, without wishing, you know, having done the Australian stereotypes, I'm kind of wary of doing the Turkish stereotypes here. But you are, I think, expected to kind of accept him as a sort of everyman, you know, one of us. Mm. And then, of course, he falls in love and finds redemption and things like that. And it's a little bit soapy. It's a bit sudsy. It's the acting is a little bit broad. But it probably is, it has to be said, a more or at least as accurate a reflection of contemporary Turkey as Nuri's films are.
Yeah, which I've always felt were more an actual reflection of Nuri Bilge's interior.
Yeah, and certain art house tastes. This is probably more authentic, if anything.
Right, I might have a little flavour of that. It's on release in more of the sort of Turkish community, sort of Holloway.
I would expect so, yeah.
In Greenwich, I believe. Not a huge release for that one. I've seen another art house release called In the City of Sylvia, which is actually at Venice 2007, so I had to go and see it again. It's by a Spaniard called José Luis Guerin, even though it's set in Strasbourg, and it basically consists of a very good-looking French bloke following a very good-looking Spanish girl around town from behind in a
this
kind of very
traditional
weird way.
Art house movie, doesn't it?
It is. I mean, basically, the first 50 minutes of it is him sitting at a cafe going, she's quite cute. She's quite cute. Basically, he's in the city of Sylvia. He's fallen in love with a girl called Sylvia there many years ago, and he's come back basically to try and find her again. I mean, the problem is, as I think with many art house films, as I also think with Nuri Bilge Ceylan, is that often the protagonist in these films is an extremely unlikable male who obviously the director thinks is really likable.
Yeah, thinks he's kind of cool and sophisticated.
Yeah, and he's clearly a wanker in this film. And in fact, she turns around and says to him, it's not very nice following people around. Would you just fuck off? And he's like, oh, no, but I've fallen in love with you. Your name is Sylvia. And she's like, no, it's not. Go away.
Is this one of those amour fou stories?
No, it's just fou.
Right, it's just fooey.
Yeah, it really... I mean, I didn't... There are people, I think, out there who will hail this as genius because of the kind
of... Well, they already have. This seems to be a film that is whipping up great excitement among certain of our colleagues in the London screen rooms who are urging me to see it.
Literally no excitement in it at all. It is 90 minutes and it feels like 90 hours, I have to say. Although, I don't want to kind of dismiss the art on display. It definitely kind of captures the feeling of Strasbourg waking up. Mm. You get familiar with neighbourhoods. There is some definite skill involved. I just don't think the bloke who made it is very nice. I don't really want to spend any time with him. He might start following me around.
Yeah, possibly, Jason. You know, he's only human, after all.
Although I'm not a girl in a vest top. Every single girl in there has gorgeous shoulders and beautiful hair. People will tell you it's genius. You need a lot of patience to kind of arrive at the genius conclusion for
okay,
this
OK, maybe we'll both skip each other's films that we've seen.
Brilliant. Well, I'm glad we've recommended those to everyone else. Maybe a film that people will want to go and see because it has starry names attached is The Burning Plain. It's written and directed by Guillermo Arriaga, he of Amores Perros and Babel and 21 Grams. And it stars Charlize Theron and Kim Basinger.
You make me so happy.
I hope your father's rotting in hell. That wetback took away the best thing I ever had. It's their father's fault that my kids lost their mom.
Mom!
Now, Zan, I won't kind of try and untangle those complicated relationships there that Arriaga has put on the screen, because I think basically that is what you have to do during the film. It is basically trying to get undone a very difficult knot.
Yeah, it's a Gordian knot, isn't it?
That's the word, Gordian.
and, you know, it's galled difficult, I think, at times. And Arriaga, I think, kind of prides himself on this sort of multi-strand, complicated film that shows its hand very slowly and is very, very clever, and you have to sort of grapple with it. At times, as with Amores Perros, that works great. That's fantastic. And that had a real kind of snap and bite and pace. At other times, as with Babel, I thought it was a bit kind of flatulent and self-important. And this, I had the same problems with, really.
there's often this, when with these fractured narrative films, you sometimes think, well, if you were told it in a normal way, in a linear way, would it be actually interesting?
No,
at all?
It wouldn't.
Don't and you think so? Because I thought The Burning Plain might have that.
Yeah.
I thought there was a lot of kind of relationships, and it was about harm and scars and the past, and could we rectify that? Can we prettify it? Can we paper over those or plastic surgery over those?
It's a moot point, isn't it? It's almost like he kind of writes, and in this case directs, as a sort of an exercise in playing with non-linear things. That he's almost like he's written the script and then thinks, right, now I'm going to put part 5 as part 1 yeah. and part 6 as part 12 and mixes it up. And it's a sort of sophistry that can get irritating
it
at
can,
times. It
yeah.
becomes a sort of a tick and a shtick.
I thought that in Babel, definitely.
Yeah.
But a lot of people loved it.
A lot of people really loved it. And I think it's a film that makes you feel clever for kind of grappling with it and unpicking it. And I'm sure this film has an audience too. And it's very well acted. I think Charlize Theron is great as this sort of anguished, embittered manager of this sort of swish restaurant up in Oregon.
Self-harming,
promiscuous, all of the kind of the bad things, the things that we're coded to know that there are secrets in her past.
She was like this as Eileen Wuornos, except she wasn't hot. She's hot.
She's hot. She's Charlize. And she's back to being Charlize, but just with a bit of darkness thrown in there.
Yeah. Kim Basinger, who...
she's great,
or Basinger, I shall call her both throughout the show.
We can edit it later.
She's very good. She did, to me, when she came on screen, I thought, like, she's supposed to be this kind of fairly sort of almost trailer trashy kind of mom, and I thought that she's just too Botoxed and beautiful to be a trailer trashy mom, but actually throws herself into that role rather well, I thought.
Yeah, I think she's good in it. I think it's a strongly acted film, and it is intriguing up to a point, but I think I kind of guessed where it was going after about sort of 10 minutes or so, and it does sort of shuffle the time frames and actually sort of shuffles generations. I mean, it's not even like, you know, a few weeks here and there. This is like years.
See, I got over that puzzle quite
right.
because I know it's Arriaga, so I thought, well, it's bound to be a sort of almost, you know, cubist portrait. It's like doing a Rubik's Cube, and you do side and then they'll all fall into place, although I've never managed to do that. This, I kind of thought, so I could see where it's going, and I actually could concentrate on the linear story that was at its heart, and I wasn't too bothered by the time, because I worked out who was who and where they were all going to go. And I actually quite enjoyed this way of telling what would have been maybe slightly dull in a linear fashion.
But it's decoration, isn't it? I mean, you think that actually mixing with the form makes the actual story better?
So, no, I thought that maybe that's how memories come back to you in pieces.
Okay.
And that's how psychology is built up in pieces. For this film, I really sort of enjoyed the benefit of the doubt. I enjoyed the game, but I thought there was much more at play here, and I thought it was rather beautiful and kind of rather sad as well.
It's sad, and it works up to a point, but in the end, and I'd found it a little bit oppressive.
Yeah.
And I didn't think it added up to a really significant piece
of
work.
It's interesting because I think The Burning Plain and In the City of Sylvia are both about time and memory, and in fact play with time and memory. And In the City of Sylvia does it in almost just as arty a way, but not as artificial, I suppose, as Arriaga. So they're both interesting on that point about love and the kind of memories that it leaves and the kind of scars.
It's a real little subgenre, this, isn't it? There's a real a kind of wave of films that are explicitly concerned with memory and how we kind of farm the past and make sense of it and things like that. And this is right in that kind of vein.
So we're going to hear from Arriaga in just a minute, Zan, about how he does organise his day and his writing, and if he does just throw the script up and down and kind of pick bits and see which bits come down. Zan, thanks very much for joining us again this week. If you want to read any more from Zan Brooks, go to www.guardian.co.uk/film. As you heard there, Zan and I were discussing the work of Guillermo Arriaga, who makes his directing debut with The Burning Plain this week. He forms part of the Mexican New Wave with directors such as Alejandro González Iñárritu, Alfonso Cuarón, and, of course, Guillermo del Toro. But I met up with Guillermo Arriaga, and I asked him whether it was the solitary nature of writing that finally turned him towards directing.
No, you know, when you are writing, you are so isolated, so lonely, that you really envy the people that are outside working on the set and say, no, I want to go out. I want to be with a great crew. I want to work with the actors I want. I want to be in the landscapes I want. So going out was one of the things that appealed me more.
You just wanted to get out.
I just want to get out. You know, it's...
I know how you feel. I write reviews every week and I'm thinking, God, I want to play football. I want to do stuff.
Exactly. Having collaboration, when you're writing, you're too much by yourself. You cannot turn to anyone and say, and now? And when you're writing, you're creating a world when you're directing, you already have the work created. You're just interpreting, and it's you can turn to someone and say, and now what should we do? I wasn't trained as a filmmaker. I always thought that I lacked the technical knowledge. I was a little bit overwhelmed by which lens should I use in this one, where should I put the camera. And then I say, if I don't know something, I can imagine the solution. And that's how I directed. I learned that it's the technical knowledge is not as important as having a clarity in the story you want to tell.
Well, it's interesting you say clarity in the story you want to tell, because of all the screenwriters and all the directors in the world, you, Guillermo Arriaga, I would say, make the most almost deliberately confusing storylines in the world to confuse the viewer, but not to confuse us. I mean, I'm not saying that we don't know where the story is going and how it matches up, but we never know until the last minute, really, how the jigsaw all fits together.
Well, but in the end, it's clear. Everything's clear. That's what I'm telling about your clarity. I always think that a storyteller has to be like a cat. However you throw the cat, it has to fall in its 4 feet. Mm-hmm. So that's why I envision myself. I can give any twist and that kind of things while in the things I'm writing, but you have always to make it clear to fall in your 4 feet.
Yeah. Let's talk about the process a bit then of writing a film like that, because when you and the Mexican New Wave came along and you did this multi-stranded storytelling, what we call fractured narrative, non-linear narrative, it was such a new thing in world cinema. It became almost the signifier of Mexican New Wave. That's what they did. It was seen, which it must have been quite nice for you as the writer, although presumably the directors got more of the kudos.
Well, I'm very proud that the Amores Perros become like the point of departure of this new cinema. I think that the Amores Perros gave confidence to Mexican and Latin American directors and writers that things can be possible, that the work you do can be influential. I was amazed that something you write by yourself, basically by yourself in a very personal story, suddenly becomes influential in the rest of the world. And I cannot be more happy that happened, and more overwhelmed and honored that happened.
So let's turn to the Burning Plain, which I greatly enjoyed as ever. And I thought maybe, because I read your novel as well, The Night Buffalo, which not everyone has read, but I did. So there you go. Thank you very much. get some money in the coffers for that one. But I thought, well, maybe now he's directing a film, because it's his first film, he's going to try and do it simple. He's going to try and tell a story from A to B to C to D. Uh-uh, that wasn't the case, Guillermo. You're still fracturing the narrative and confusing me. But this was sort of less. This was more about time than different characters, I felt, this one.
I have always tried to write a story in the structure more organic to tell the story. I do not have a previous way of writing, a previous structure. I'm finding it while I'm writing it. Oh. It's not that I decide I'm going to use this structure now. It's like, okay, I'm writing it. I think that now I need to change the point of view. Now I need to go to another story. I don't have a plan. I don't have a map. I began discovering the structure while I'm writing it.
Oh, okay.
And that's how it has been. It works in all of my stories.
It's a very good way of telling a mystery, really, about a woman who we can't know and who we can't understand. And you kind of go back into her various parts of her life and her psyche and her mind. I think it's a kind of ingenious way. Where did you come up with this kind of method of storytelling? Is it in some literature that you read before that was your influence?
I think it has two influences. One is personal. I suffer attention deficit disorder, so this is the way I think. it's not for me. It's very difficult to go from A to B to C to D. I don't have the discipline or the mental logic to process like that.
Right.
I feel much more comfortable jumping from one place to the other. And second, I'm a novelist, so I try to bring the novelistic, very literary forms to the cinema writing. I like to begin my stories in media res, that means in the middle of the action. And if you read García Márquez in 100 Years of Solitude, that it begins like many years later when he was going to be executed. Mm. he remembered the day he and he goes back and forth.
Yeah.
And Vargas Llosa also comes back and forth in his books, and Cortázar also.
So do you map it out on your desk at home? Is there a, this is this plot line, this is Charlize in the modern day, this is her as Mariana in the olden day?
No, never map nothing.
Maybe you should.
No, why?
I don't know. You're doing all right without it. I don't know why you should.
It's in my head.
Congratulations on The Burning Plain, the first of your directing your own scripts. I assume it won't be the last.
I hope I can direct soon.
They're looking for the Bond movie. They need a new director.
Well, maybe I'll direct the Bond movie. My great, great and good friend Mark Foster did a wonderful job, so maybe I can follow his steps.
Yeah, I'd love to see Bond, like what the Bond audience would do if you started going, whether he's over there and different countries at the same time, and then it's backwards. Hold on.
With dogfights.
Yes, with dogfights. That would mess with their mind, Guillermo. That's what we need to do.
Yeah, we can have an intertwined Bond story.
I look forward to it. Guillermo, muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias, Jason.
And The Burning Plain is out on release in the UK on Friday, March the 13th. And that is all we have time for in this week's Film Weekly. My thanks to my guests this week, to Tom Hardy, to Guillermo Arriago, and my podcasting pal Zan Brooks. From me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly this week, Sarah Peters, it's goodbye.